Just a little bit of trade today, I promise. Economic data and the release thereof. Also, holograms. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is the 16th of January today, Thursday. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We will abstain as best we can from mentioning trade on the program today, save for these two items. Number one, the Senate passed the USMCA today, so that is a done deal. And number two, we learned this morning that business inventories fell in November, the biggest drop they've had in a couple of years. You're looking here for the connection, I imagine, right? Between trade and how much stuff companies are keeping in the warehouse. Well, good thing Mitchell Hartman's on duty today then, huh?
Think of business inventories as stuff sitting on shelves waiting to be sold. That could be piles of 2x4s at a lumber wholesaler ready to be shipped to Home Depot, or products sitting in Amazon warehouses that no one's clicked to buy yet. When business inventories fall, it can mean a couple things. Either stuff's flying off the shelves because sales are up and the economy's hot, or
it could mean that spending is slowing down, production is slowing down.
Economist Ben Herzon at IHS Market thinks that's what explains November's decline. Businesses built up inventories in early 2019 when the economy was booming. Then they cut back heading into 2020 because the economy was slowing down. That's the case at Air Tractor, a company that makes aircraft for agriculture and forestry in Olney, Texas. David Eichert is CFO.
We've slowed it basically because just a matter of caution. We want to be careful and not get caught with too much inventory.
Air Tractor's business is heavily dependent on U.S. farmers who've been suffering from the trade war. Inventories are also down at Hawthorne Auto Clinic, a five-bay repair shop in Portland, Oregon. Sarah Heidler is the service advisor.
So we're going to a more on-demand system for stocking parts.
Does that actually free up shelf space?
Shelf space and money, yeah. We have seen an increase in parts prices, especially those things that are have a lot of metal in them, so batteries, things like that.
Chalk that up to tariffs as well. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We can close the books now on the 2019 year in retail. The National Retail Federation said this morning holiday sales were up 4% from a year earlier. And for all of 2019, the Commerce Department says retail sales were up almost 6%, a whole lot of that online. Marketplace's Justin Ho has the retail recap.
Shoppers entered 2019 after a pretty rough holiday season. In late 2018, trade tensions ignited. The stock market freaked out, and the government shut down for over a month. So it's no wonder that when you look at online sales over 2019,
it looks like it was almost 12 months of consecutive increases.
That's Jack Kleinhens, chief economist at the National Retail Federation. He says online sales in 2019 grew by over 13%, and not just at big online giants like Amazon. Brick-and-mortar retailers invested in making online shopping smoother.
They're looking at trying to meet the needs of consumers, whether it's buying in-store or buying online and picking up at store.
In-store pickup revenue rose by 35% in 2019, according to Adobe Digital Insights. Lead analyst Vivek Pandia says big box retailers have an advantage here.
They have the logistic chains that can make sure that that's a seamless experience for consumers.
Plus, e-commerce isn't just about clothes or electronics or holiday gifts. Rachel Dalton follows e-commerce at Kantar Consulting. She says 2019 was the year that online grocery shopping started to go mainstream.
And so a lot of the grocers like the Kroger's and Albertsons of the world are also putting a lot more investment into technology in that space.
She says this year we're going to see more development in curbside pickup and grocery delivery. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, two words, gang. Corporate is the first one. Profits is the second. Record highs when we do the numbers. First First Friday of every month on this program, dedicated listeners will hear us talking about the jobs report for the prior month. It's a big deal, and of course, everybody in business and economics is paying attention. The markets are too, which makes an announcement today by the Bureau of Labor Statistics especially relevant. The Bureau says it's going to stop letting journalists publish stories about the jobs data the instant that data is released. It's a big change to what's called the lockup, the half hour or so that journalists have gotten to digest the numbers before they're officially out and write their stories. Lorraine Wallert is an editor at Politico, also a veteran of many of those lockups herself. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Kai.
First of all, what's it like on a jobs day Friday morning? What happens in this lockup?
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Well, it's a very high adrenaline day. It's usually an early morning, and you get locked into literally a windowless room. There's literally a switch that turns off all access to the outside world. The door is locked. There's an armed guard. Wow. And you have about 30 minutes to digest, you know, an entire month of economic data.
Okay. Now, I get that it's market moving and you have to be careful with it. Why this lockup? What does it do for you?
There are a few things. First of all, okay, it is very valuable data. And so the lockup is essentially a type of embargo. It levels the playing field so that the maximum number of people can get the information at exactly the same time. So no one has an unfair advantage. You put, you know, 20 people in a room, and those 20 people at the exact same millisecond send the information to the entire planet. So there's no sort of technological race or other kind of arms race to get to the data before anyone else. Everyone gets it at the same time.
Right. Okay. So now in theory, what's going to happen is that after the 1st of March, which is to say the jobs day on which we will get the February jobs data, you're going to have 11 bajillion people crashing the Bureau of Labor Statistics website, which is, as you and I both know, because we've tried it, not robust. There's going to be a challenge here in actually getting this data out.
Correct. That's correct. And don't forget the way the government packages data like a government, right? So
right.
They're going to release not necessarily the most important number at the top. They're going to say, here's the top line number, here's the second number, and they're going to do the same way every single month, regardless of circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
So frequently the news or the market moving number is going to be buried on, you know, the equivalent of a footnote on page 27.
Yeah. In theory, this is, well, so the BLS has said that, you know, they want to prevent technological advances from giving certain organizations an edge. Fine. But certainly in the early stages, and I'm talking number of months here as they work this out, there will be some volatility on those first Fridays of the month at 8:30 and 2 seconds, right?
Absolutely. There's already volatility at 8:30 and 1 millisecond.
Right.
So multiply that by, oh, gosh, did you say gajillion? What was the number?
11
I'd
gajillion,
multiply
I think
by
is
that.
What I said.
Yeah. I would use that.
Would you miss it? I mean, you're not doing this gig anymore, but would you miss it if you didn't get to do this?
You know, don't tell my boss. I already miss it. So I think it's going to be a loss, not just for the markets. Not just for the media, you know, culturally, you know, you get something out of this. I mean, my boss was a former currency trader, and he would find mistakes in the government's numbers inside the lockup.
Oh, man.
And so, you know, there is a service being provided by the people who are in that room.
Lorraine Wallert used to do it. She's an editor at Politico. Lorraine, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Kai.
I don't know what the actual guesstimate is for how much money is going to be spent this election cycle, but it's going to be in the billions, mid-single-figure billions is what I've read, which is one way of noting that it's been 10 years since the Supreme Court ruled in Citizens United that companies and organized labor and other associations have a First Amendment right to spend money freely on politics. So now an unprecedented amount of money is being raised and spent to influence who next gets to move into the White House. But it keeps getting harder to figure out where all that money is coming from. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has a look at one group that's become kind of Washington famous for digging into money in politics.
A former politician becomes an undercover lobbyist. An anonymous donor spends millions on attack ads. A shell corporation masking a foreign-backed media campaign. In this town, when there's a scoop about secret money in politics, it usually has a familiar name attached to it.
I do want to bring in Sheila Krumholtz.
Sheila Krumholtz heads
And Sheila Krumholtz is executive director of the Center for Responsive Politics.
The Center for Responsive Politics is probably the best-known outfit in the small world of campaign finance investigations. Data from CRP's online news outlet, Open Secrets, shows up in news reports, research papers, even campaign ads. And Krumholtz is the face of it.
Sheila she's just a rock star in this field. She is somebody that I think everyone who writes about this and researches in this field looks to as an authoritative voice.
That's coming from Ellen Weintraub, the chair of the Federal Election Commission, who one could argue is the authority on stuff like this. The commission is supposed to make sure everyone is playing fair in elections. It's one of the sources of data for the Center for Responsive Politics, but not the only one. CRP staffers also comb through tax records, business licenses, and other government documents, all to track how money moves in Washington.
I feel pretty evangelical about the need for transparency in politics.
Sheila Krumholtz joined CRP back in 1989 as an executive assistant when what's now the Open Secrets website was a book, a tome, she calls it. It was 1,500 pages long, cost more than $100, and took a lot of legwork.
We often would have to physically go to the Federal Election Commission to literally look in dusty filing cabinets to get information.
Now, most of that data is online and free, but hard for most people to understand.
For the numbers heavy piece, let's put that in a dashboard form rather than in a narrative form.
Sure.
So Krumholtz and her staff spend most of their time organizing, labeling, and tagging information. The Center for Responsive Politics does have its critics. Brad Smith is a former Republican FEC chair and now runs the Institute for Free Speech, which works to ease some campaign finance restrictions. Smith says CRP provides a useful service because it takes complicated information and
puts it in the data that's sort of sexier, you know, with neat graphs, and they sort it and dice it and slice it in different ways that are of some interest.
But Smith argues in the quest to make things easy for regular people to understand, the group overemphasizes certain types of political money since the Citizens United decision opened the floodgates.
For example, things like dark money. If you read sort of how the information is presented, you would think we were just had become awash with this kind of spending.
That kind of money, where donors can stay secret, is just a small part of campaign funding. But Smith is right that it does get a lot of attention. And Krumholtz is okay with that, arguing that the money hardest to trace probably deserves a bit more scrutiny.
I think people get that money is hugely influential. It's not everything. And yet, for the vast majority of races, about 90% of the races, the candidate who spends the most wins on election day.
And Krumholtz says the source of the money that gets them there matters. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Coming up, it looks like a ghost that's sort of trying to materialize and isn't quite there.
The future of live entertainment, if you're into that sort of thing. First, though, let's do the numbers. Three new record highs on Wall Street today. Dow Industrials gained 267 points, 0.9%, 29,297. The NASDAQ up 98 points, 1%, 93.57. The S&P 500 up 27 points, 0.8%, 33.16. 100 years ago tonight at midnight, Prohibition went into effect in the United States. So let's check in on the booze business, shall we? AB InBev, ticker symbol BUD, lost 0.6%. Last week, the company announced its Super Bowl ads would include one touting both Bud Light and Bud Light Seltzer. Whatever. Molson Coors, ticker symbol TAP, is going to advertise its new low-carb St. Archer Gold beer the week of the big game. It closed up 0.1%. Today, you're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate minority leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. You want to spend more time with Marketplace? Connect with us and the other folks who make this show work. Follow us on Twitter. We're at Marketplace. You can find us at Marketplace APM on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram.
Fast. Marketplace helps you keep up with our Alexa skill. Just say, "Make me smart" on any Echo device and hear something new explained every day from Molly Wood and Kai Rizdahl. Everything from how streaming music works to whatever happened to the $1,000 bill. Say, "Make me smart" on any Echo device to get started.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It has faded from the headlines here, anyway, given trade and impeachment. But Britain's going to leave the European Union at the end of the month. January 31st is officially now Brexit Day, which really is when the hard work is going to start, specifically the UK making a fresh trade deal with the European Union. The EU warned this week that any deal, though, is going to depend on reaching an agreement over fishing rights. Who gets to take how many fish and from where? The BBC's political correspondent Ross Hawkins went to southwest England to see how the fishermen are feeling.
And I turned up in the dark and seen some lights and the trawler was there. And by that time, he already towed 300 pots away.
It's just the sort of tale that drove some to embrace Brexit in the first place. On his boat, skipper Jake Gilbert tells me how a French trawler wrecked his crab fishing gear in British waters. Martin, the boat's owner, is his dad.
And that cost you how much?
Over £20,000. £20,000 of a loss of crab gear, plus the loss of the crab. So bring on Brexit.
Their Brexit demand, chuck out all foreign fishing boats from waters near the British coast.
43 years I've been fishing out of Newquay, and we've had a crap deal all our life.
Across the country in Lowestoft, in East Anglia, they say there's the potential to take seven times the amount of fish, the quota they're allowed to catch now in their seas. Peter Aldous, the local Conservative MP there.
A sevenfold increase of what quota stocks, those fishing stocks that are subject to quota, to actually be caught by UK vessels in the southern North Sea.
And the British government thinks for some fish in some seas that is a realistic aim, one source tells me. The UK is expected to argue it gives away £500 million of fishing opportunities every year at the moment, with continental boats dependent on UK seas, and to demand an entirely new system, possibly based on Norway's fish deal with the EU. They insist they have the majority and the mandate to do this.
If you start negotiations with a huge expectation, you may not get that expectation, let's say, fulfilled.
But the EU's fishing lobby has its own expectations and likes the current arrangements. I asked Gerard van Boelsvoort, chair of the European Fisheries Alliance, if he's simply demanding his boats are allowed to take in future no less percentage of the available catch that's allowed than you do at the moment.
That's our objective, yes. Yes.
And do you think that's realistic?
Yep, I think that's realistic, yes, of course.
And the EU, knowing that fishermen like Martin sell much of their crab catch on the continent, is expected to try to tie fishing to the wider Brexit trade talks. Barry Dees of the National Federation of Fishermen's Organisations.
What we have are polar positions, really. We have the UK saying that radical change is required, and the EU wanted to, for vested interests, want to stay as close to the status quo as possible, using trade as the leverage.
And if British vested interests won out, could French fishermen blockade ports?
As day follows night, they've done it for much less reasons.
My underwear will change for me on February 1st. That's all that's going to happen on the 1st of February. Brexit is not going to happen, is it? Straight away.
Martin knows fishing's rules won't change on Brexit Day at the end of the month. They'll have to wait till next year. But the fate of this small, iconic industry could dictate whether Brexit seems a success or a failure in the short term. It would be a brave politician who dashed these great expectations. In Newquay, Cornwall, I'm the BBC's Ross Hawkins for Marketplace.
Music as a business is changing. We know that, right? But live music is live music. You pay your money, you get to see your favorite performer live and in the flesh. Except not always. Holograms, it turns out, could be the next big moneymaker in music. Dearly departed stars on stage, kinda. Mark Benelli wrote about it for the New York Times magazine. Mark, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I'm just going to say it flat out, man. This is weird, this whole hologram concert thing.
You're not alone in that feeling.
How does it work? I mean, you pay your money, you go into a theater, auditorium, whatever, and there's a hologram of like Frank Zappa up there?
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's like going to a regular concert. There's a live band, but the lead performer is a hologram. And so by oh, go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to say, do you ever watch CNN in the afternoon sometimes and they have that segment where somebody stands in the middle of a set and there's a hologram projection of whatever it is and it just looks weird? Does it look like that? Does it look weird?
Wasn't there a hologram of Wolf Blitzer?
Yeah, well, that's a whole different slightly terrifying thing. But, I mean, doesn't it just look weird?
It looks a little off. It looks, so I say in the piece, it looks like a ghost that's sort of trying to materialize and isn't quite there. It's a little bit brighter than the live musicians on stage. Yeah, it's a little strange. That said, you know, I went to the Zappa show the opening night at a theater, and I was probably about 8 rows from the front. And, you know, it looks like Zappa up there. It just looks strange. It looks, you know, you can tell it's a little off.
Okay, now, why?
Why now?
Why? Why do the estates of Frank Zappa want to do this? I mean, clearly they're making money, right?
Yeah. Well, as one of the hologram reps put it to me, I mean, it was a very interesting way to look at it. But if you think about the way the music industry works now, you know, it's all streaming. Streaming royalties, it's just, you know, pennies.
Sure.
It's very, very small.
Yeah.
Live artists today make most of their money touring. So, for these estates, you know, how do they keep an income stream going? You know, they have to keep Frank on the road, mm-hmm. or Roy, or right. Whitney.
And it has to be said here, pointed out actually, that a lot of the biggest touring artists right now ain't no spring chickens.
The top three of 2019 were Rolling Stones, number one, Elton John, number two, and Bob Seger, number three.
Hmm.
10 of the top 20 tours last year were artists who were 60 and older. So in addition to those top three I mentioned, there are people like Cher and Kiss,
mm-hmm.
Paul McCartney, mm-hmm. Billy Joel. So yeah, they're, you know, hopefully they'll all still be around, but they're probably not going to be touring.
One does wonder what like the Taylor Swifts and the Billie Eilishes of the world think about all this.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, as someone pointed out to me, if you were going to be a proactive participant in this as an artist, you get yourself scanned,
right?
You know, at your peak, at your youthful peak, and then you'd have this hologram in the can.
Right. 30-year-old Taylor Swift forever, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay, so you went to the Frank Zappa show. You were 8 rows back. How much did it cost, and was it worth it?
Gosh, I can't tell. I don't know how much it cost because I was comped.
Oh, you're killing me.
But the way the show worked was pretty interesting. They assembled this band made up predominantly of people who toured with him in the past. So
yeah,
it was a very hot band, really great players. So the crowd loved seeing these guys. And the hologram only appeared probably for about 30% of the show.
Oh, really?
Yeah, no, somebody told me that they thought of it as like the shark in Jaws. You don't want to see the shark all the time. It has to sort of pop up occasionally, and then people get very excited. So when the hologram wasn't there, they could project all kinds of trippy, psychedelic wow. visuals that would go with the music, and then he would materialize and do a guitar solo or something, and people would go nuts.
Wow. All right. So Frank Zappa, scale it up for me, though, and talk to me about somebody like Whitney Houston, who, you know, would sell out 60,000-seat arenas. Is that doable?
Yeah, I think that's going to be the big test case. Whitney Houston will be debuting about a month from now. And that's, you know, she's yeah. the sort of biggest artist that they've tried to tour on this level. And we'll see how it works. It's going to be a big production. They like to compare it to like these big jukebox musicals, you know.
Uh-huh.
So the idea isn't to trick you into thinking you're seeing a Whitney Houston right. concert necessarily. It's bringing her music back with dancers and live musicians and then this hologram at the center of it.
It's a piece called Old Musicians Never Die, They Just Become Holograms. Mark Benelli wrote it. He's a contributing writer at the New York Times Magazine. Mark, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
This final note on the way out today, which comes with a tip of the hat to Mitchell Hartman. Mitchell pitched a story in our meeting this morning about the flu and people coming to work when they're sick and how the unemployment rate can actually be a factor in more people getting sick. And I said, no, come on, really? And he said, yeah, there's a study I saw somewhere. So I Googled it. And sure enough, from the National Bureau of Economic Research, issued in 2010, revised last year, a paper originally circulated with the title, Are Pink Slips Better Than Flu Shots? The key line of which is, we find that a 1 percentage point increase in the employment rate increases the number of influenza-related doctor visits by about 16%. So number one, don't go to work when you're sick. Number two, get your flu shot. All right, we're going. Dow Industrial's up 267 today, 0.9%. NASDAQ up 98 points, 1%. S&P 500 picked up 27 points, 0.8%. Record highs all the way around. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, and John Gordon are the Marketplace editing staff. Betsy Streisand is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.